Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
The animal is so difficult to get. It must have been very difficult to get in the old days when they had to use nothing but hand harpoons with ivory or bone heads on them.
Must have been pretty strong, man.
But they killed whales in the old days, although with very much difficulties. For instance, my great uncle was and some members of his crew were killed by a whale he had struck with one of those hand harpoons. Mm-hmm. But since the latter part of 1800, the people there had obtained the use of timing device, sort of a time bomb device, weapons, which they are using now to kill their whales.
These are the Gatling guns.
They don't call them Gatling guns. They call one in their harpoon and something like that. One in the painting there. They call it the dotting gun. And the gun they used to actually shoot the whale with is called the shoulder gun.
Okay. Maybe we can talk about your painting a little bit and talk about when did you begin to be interested in art, painting?
Well, I seem to have been interested in art ever since I was a little kid. When I was a child, well, some of my teachers used to ask the children to draw some things they knew and they have seen, and I used to do that and enjoyed it, and I used to draw birds like the longspur and snowbirds and ptarmigans and things like that, which was very interesting for me.
How did it happen? Could you tell me the story of how you left the village of Point Hope and went all the way to the University of Washington to study art?
Well, it was this way.
How much of an effect has the division of the land has had on the native people, like dividing the Alaska into 12 regional corporations? Do you think it has it's better or worse?
No, the 12 Native corporations were set up to handle the proceeds of the native land claims, which eventually should equal about $1 billion. In fact, about $964 million, somewhere around there. And this will have to be taken care of, and that's why the native corporations in 12 regions have been set up. And they are now doing business, and at the moment they are getting contracts, some of which are worth millions of dollars. And this is the way I would like to see it, so the corporations can get these types of contracts through the years ahead, so they can keep going and profit and make profits with their corporation, so the money will be perpetually available even to the generations in the future.
Do you think that the older people understand the land claims?
This is a very difficult piece of legislation, that Alaskan Native Land Claims. It's very complex, and I myself, even now, have had a difficult time with it, even though I have been working with it for years. It's so complex that it's amazing how the Native leadership had caught on to it very early. Well, about 6 years ago, 6 to 7 years ago, and which means that they're very bright. And we were very happy in the tender times when the leadership finally started to spring up from different areas like the North Slope and the interior and in the northwest area and southwest area, and all the people that sprung up as leaders from those areas are very bright and vocal, and they always made very fine quotes for our Tundra Times.
What about the younger people? Do you think that they understand the land claims bill?
Well, like I said, the land claims subject is a very complex one, and efforts are being made. In fact, some colleges have been mentioned now, just to get the people more acquainted with the land claims, what the land claims is and was all about. And I believe this is a good idea, because they will have to work with it, and they will have to continue to work with this land matter clear into the future. And the thorough knowledge of land matters in Alaska, as far as the Native people are concerned, is a very important thing, because knowing the subject quite thoroughly will help a great deal to whoever the leadership might be in the future, and this knowledge will certainly help them to keep the thing going on an even keel, more or less.
Do you think that the younger people with the coming of the land claims and a push to learn to live with a cash-based economy, and then a push from the older people to learn to live in a subsistence-type economy. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the problems that has caused? And
well, we just can't help but meet the cash economy that has come upon us quite a ways back. And in fact, like at Point Hope, that's where I was born, yeah, the people themselves has taken this job as their own problem, without asking any help from anybody, not even asking the government for help, or the way they're handling the problem. They the folks at Point Hope managed to accept and reject certain things of the Western cultures. And of course, it is well known what one of the things they have accepted is the rifle, which they have learned to use and needed and have gotten to need it, you know, the need for it through the years, and it has helped them get their subsistence hunting capabilities much better than with the bow and arrow they used to use in the old days. And of course there are other things like beauty rest mattresses and pillows and snow machines and washing machines and all that, which they like very much. And women pretty much involved in this because they like these things, and like any women in the world, I believe, and they are quite influential in getting some of these things, learning to use them like their cousins or distant cousins in the lower 48. Excuse me.
I understand you are also a poet. How did this come about?
Well, I'm something of a poet, but I'm not a very good one. And some of the things that have gotten a little bit of attention have been the products of my effort that took a lot of time. And this is poetry is a pretty hard thing for me to do. Some people seem to do it in a very easy manner, but not for me.
What kind of poetry do you write?
Well, I write things like Kishona. That's a poem about my mother, as I remembered her when I was a little boy, going to school and things like that. And how she was and how she treated me and all this sort of stuff, and which of course was very impressive to me at the time and now. And she was always a very fine inspiration for a little lady who has lived in the Arctic under very severe conditions and did a real good job. And she was also a very comical little lady, and in times of stress, sometimes she would do things that made us laugh, and even under serious conditions. And she was very fine in that way.
What do you think about the Eskimo sense of humor?
The Eskimo sense of humor, as well as the Indian sense of humor, springs up any time in Alaska. It can be at meetings, it can be at conventions, it can be any time, it can be at home, which is very, very refreshing, because I don't know, it might have sprung from the very severe surroundings these people, our people, have always lived under. And like I said a while ago about my mother, even under severe conditions, she was able to make a quip that made us laugh, even under some serious conditions. And in this way, she made things easier to meet, easier to deal with, such things as unfavorable hunting conditions and unfavorable ice conditions and storms and winds and all that sort of stuff.
Do you think we could do a film on maybe if you're reciting some of your poetry?
Poetry?
Yeah. Some of the poetry that you...
Again, I don't know. Well, I don't consider my poetry as the best thing in the world. But if you can find some kind of a story from some of them, well, I wouldn't kick against it. I would like to see you try it anyway and see what comes out.
Okay. Maybe we can go ahead.
Well, you want to ask me something first?
And maybe...
Is you ready?
Yeah. Maybe you can read it and then talk about it.
Mm-hmm. In Memoriam, Kishona. How cold the sword about you, Kishona. Glinting frost, swirling drifts of snow, driven by unfeeling wind. Then a brief respite of a single moon, since the great sun traverses the sky around, defying the accustomed horizon, nourishing therefore a cluster of forget-me-nots that bursts into a soul-stirring blue upon your simple arctic grave. How slight and frail you were, but you faced with humble courage the unkind elements that were your lot, and thus emerged triumphant with a generous share of love for your fellow man. I was blessed with deeper love you bestowed upon me, Kishona. Love divinely tender, love that seemed caressed with the touch of heaven. Recollections fail me now. You uttered no words of endearment. But I remember well a gentle hug, adoring light within your eyes that told me of love more than 10,000 words. How cold a sword about you, Kishona. Glinting frost, swirling drifts of snow, driven by unfeeling wind. However cold your resting place, my heart within me whispers, your rest is blessed in quiet peace, because you gave so well your love to your fellow man and me, a son to you, Kishona.
How did you come about to write that?
Well, it was out in Bainbridge Island across from Seattle. There was a Memorial Day one day out there. And I kept thinking about Alaska and my home and my mother, of course, who had, a few months before had passed away. And this is what I came up with, and because I was rather homesick and all that for my village, and therefore I wrote this poem.
Could you tell me how old you are and where, when you were born?
Yeah, I was born at Point Hope, Tikirak, they call it in our language. Tikirak, which means pointing finger, is the spit. The village is located on this spit. And I was born on August 10, 1911. And I don't know how many years that is, but you can figure that out. And that's been quite a while ago, but as I recall many things that happened in my young life, as well as more recent occasions I remember, it doesn't seem that long. This life is pretty rapid, and as well as fascinating, but altogether too short, I think.
Could you tell me about your mother and father, who they were?
Well, I was fortunate to have a father and mother who were very traditional about their ways of living and customs and all that. And
and regard for their past and their culture and all that, and traditions. And my parents weren't exactly gentle in on some occasion, but you can be sure that when they did that, we deserved it as children in our family. And these were, of course, as any family would, I guess, some punishment meted out to us as boys and girls. Of course, we were like any boys and girls, I believe, in any family. Therefore, we got into things, and that some things that we shouldn't have done, and of course, well, we got the reward, whether we liked it or not.
Where were you educated? Where did you go to school?
Well, I began my schooling at Point Hope. In fact, I heard that I started school when I was around 3 years old, and because my older sisters had been going to school, and my mother told me that I kept bothering her about wanting to go to school, and I wouldn't stop. So one day she let my oldest sister take me to mission school then, St. Thomas Mission at Point Hope. And, well, I went to school. And then, after school, my mother told me that I began to run home ahead of my sisters and falling down a couple of times along the way. And I was hollering something she couldn't hear until I was getting close to the spot where we were living. And what I said was, what I was hollering to Mother about was something like this: "Mother, Mother, I didn't let out any air in school," which meant that when my sister came home from school one day, that one of the boys had let out some air and was audible. So the teacher at that time reprimanded the little boy, and the little boy cried. That apparently impressed me a great deal, so that was the first thing I told my mother after my first year of school.
Okay, can you tell me more about your education, where you went to school after that?
Well, I went to White Mountain when I was around 14 years old, and at 14 I was still in grade school, which was due to the rather unsteady manner of schooling at first, because on account of the teachers we had, they couldn't stand the cold weather, I guess, so they stayed only 1 year and left the next year, and then sometimes there was a year skipped and there was no school that year. Therefore, after 2 years, well, school would resume, and then I'd be in second grade or something like that. And in fact, I was in second grade for about 3 years one time without knowing it, and my parents didn't know anything about it, didn't know that I was supposed to advance. But I became a very fine second grader, and after the third year, I knew every lesson that was asked of me, and it gave me time to do little things like throwing spitball with an owl skin leg tube, where you put the wad on one end, another one on the other, and then you push that, and the compression within the bone will shoot just a lot of paper across the room with somebody. And we used to do that as children in school. Of course, we got scolded for it, but we did it anyway.
How about high school and play school?
Well, I went to high school at White Mountain and managed to go through the 12th grade. And then after that, this one of my teachers who had who was an artist and who gave me the chance to get a lot more interested in art was there, and she happened to have an acquaintance in Southern Oregon, an artist who was living at that time, and both of them worked out an agreement that I should go out there and study with him, and which I did. I worked my way out on a government ship, the North Star, out to Seattle, and after that I went by bus for the first time in my life to Portland and to Medford, Oregon, Southern Oregon, and then rode a train later on for the first time also, and then I talked on the telephone for the first time in my life during that trip, and I was actually rather scared of the telephone, but I used it and got my message through.
When was that, when you first used the telephone?
I believe I was around 21 years old, or 20 or 21 years old, when I first used the telephone. And it was a rather scary thing and to me, because I was talking to an inanimate object, but I was getting a kick out of hearing the voice on the other side, several miles away. And of course, I use the telephone all the time now, which I should be used to it, and I'm not quite used to it yet.
Okay, we'll switch from the telephone to satellite communications, what we're involved in right now with this project here. What do you think about satellite?
I think it's an amazing thing that has been developed. And I believe the use of it, especially in education of our young people in Alaska, is going to be a very useful thing. In this way, they will be able to see who their leaders are, who their elders are, and how their elders and their people perform everyday lives according to their customs and traditions and all that. I think this will be a very useful thing for the young people, because they need to know their how their parents or their elders came up through the years before them, and this should be very interesting thing for them to do, because I believe that they too, the young children and the older children, will get a lot out of it, because it never fails to impress me or give me some sort of an inspiration derived from the past, like my own parents and my grandparents and what they had done and how they lived and what they made and what they ate, how they hunted and everything like that. These are very interesting things, inspirational things that I believe the children and the young students can get out of things produced through the use of the satellite.
Can you give me a little history of the jobs, some of the jobs that you've held and where you've worked?
Yes, I went to art school with this, it was a private tutoring I got from this gentleman, Max Sim, at Trail, Oregon, some 28 miles from Medford. And in return for my lessons, I learned to cook. He taught me how to cook. He taught me how to mow the lawn. He taught me how to take care of the flowers and pick tomatoes and and how to mash grapes, because gentleman made wine, very fine wine, because he was from Belgium. He was also a former naval officer, which made him rather stern. So my art education was rather severe in many cases, but he was able to probably instill in me some, additional knowledge, vital additional knowledge in art that I needed. And after I studied with him for about a year and a half, he made arrangements for me to go to University of Washington in Seattle, and that's where I had my formal art training. And what I had learned from Mr. Sims in Oregon was a very vital thing, because I used it as my basis for my artwork in school, and it gave me a little more advantage, I believe, than the other students. And I was able to, whether my work was good or not, I guess, I was able to make A's and B pluses and things like that. And we may become subservient to them, because one day, maybe in a year or so, or maybe a little longer or so, I would like to retire and do a lot of painting and writing. I have been asked to write a book about my life and what I have done, and about the land claims and especially about the operation of the Tundra Times, ever since we started it back in October 1, 1962. And we have gone through quite a lot of history during that time, and especially Native history, I believe, and these are things that I would like to put down on paper. And I have been asked by such publishers as Doubleday and Alfred Knopf, and yeah, pretty good boys, those boys, you know. So I would like to have time to do all this stuff, as well as painting and sculpting.
What is going to happen? Who will take over your role as editor of the Tundra Times if you retire?
Well, that's something we haven't settled yet, and I believe we'll be in time, I hope not too long from now, we'll be starting to train or interview some people who would maybe like to take over after I retire. We don't know anything about this yet, as yet, but I'm kind of thinking about it, and so I can have time to write and do some painting and sculpting and all that sort of stuff, and which I enjoy. I can do on my own time and things like that.
What are your goals for yourself? What lies ahead for Howard Ross?
Well, that's what I mean when I said that I would like to do a lot of painting, concentrate on it, do the best I can with the abilities I have, and see what I can come up with. And I'm very serious about my art, of course, but within the past 12 years I haven't been able to hardly touch it, because the The work we have been doing with attended times has been very time consuming and as well as constant attention. So when I retire, I will have time to think rather leisurely, perhaps, on the things I want to do, like books, and maybe try to properly plan them and all that sort of stuff.